Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm so excited to be here in one of my favourite galleries, actually, the Walker Art Gallery in Liverpool. And I'm joined by the Singh twins. Now, I have been so excited about meeting up with you. You are living legends the world of art history.
Gosh, you're making us feel really old now.
No, you're amazing. And rightly, you've been awarded MBEs for your work.
Yes, I'm very privileged to receive that, yes.
Yeah, and you've been working together. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that you have been a unit working as artists in different mediums your whole lives, pretty much.
Since the age of dot, really. Ever since we can remember, we've been side by side with a felt tip or a pencil scribbling away, sometimes in books, sometimes on the walls.
Yeah.
So this is the pleasure of our father, who very soon started buying us paper, you know, proper things to draw on. But there is a serious side to the reason why we work together, and that really stems back to our time at art college, where the fact that we were inspired by similar art forms and developed a similar personal style was a real problem for the tutors in this contemporary art course, where, you know, the cult of individuality within modern art was the be-all and end-all of everything. And I think the tutors felt that we were stifling our individuality,
really?
And copying each other, which was, you know, it could be further from the truth. We just happened to be two individuals who were inspired by the same art, and that came through
in our own practice.
Yeah. And being twins genetically, you know, similar skill sets and all of that, there was very little difference in the kind of outputs that we were creating at that time. And for us as twins, I think we wanted to sort of challenge that a little bit, because it's something we've had all our lives about this whole stereotyping of twins and twin behaviour. And so from that point onwards, we started wearing the same. We never used to wear the same at that point.
Well, that's it, I should say, because obviously this is an audio podcast.
Yeah.
But yes, you're identical twins, and you dress absolutely identically, down to the earrings, ladies.
Yeah,
I'm very impressed.
We've made an art of being the same. Well, it was really to challenge this whole idea of individuality and to kind of poke a bit of fun at it, because from our point of view, you know, although our work was very similar within the art course, our peers around us were churning out clones of Matisse and Gauguin, Picasso. Our work was actually the most original work in the whole department, if I might say so myself. And so we thought, well, where is this stereotyping coming from? And then also when you look around society and you think about how we're all dictated to by the fashion world, by the media, there's no such thing as individuality when it boils down to it. We're all influenced by something, somebody, somewhere at some time. And that's become part of our sort of key message of a lot of our work, including the fact that we physically work together on a lot of the things that we produce.
Well, I've seen lovely footage of the two of you shoulder to shoulder doing your miniature work.
That was the easy way. It's normally head to toe, so that was like...
Yeah, at least you've got a desk and some paper now. But it is, it's a really interesting problem, I can imagine, for the contemporary art world. So say, do we take you as two people, or do we take you as a collective...
Well, of course, we're two people.
Yeah.
We can't get away from that, but we are very, very close. And our ideology and the things that spark, you know, the ideas within our work are usually pretty identical, because we have identical experiences in life. And, you know, a lot of our work is inspired by our cultural heritage, our Indo-British, you know, relationship that we've both experienced, you know, as well as, you know, taking trips to America or elsewhere in the world.
So you shared all of that. Your memories are shared, your context.
So shared experiences and triggers similar interests.
So, do you still do things together now? Do you still sort of
Yeah,
live
we
alongside
do.
Each
I mean,
other.
A lot of the, well, we, yes, we live in a traditional extended Indian family, so there's us as well as the rest of the clan, if you like.
Fantastic.
And whenever we've been travelling, it's usually our work takes us travelling, so we're doing that together. There's family, we go on holidays together, so, you know, that's the way we love it. It's quite, I mean, even when we go abroad together, we feel actually we're alone because it's just the two of us. So we're kind of not really enjoying ourselves about that, the rest of the family.
Well, I came to your preview last night for your amazing new exhibition that we're standing in at the moment. And it was such a warm and exciting experience. So many people around you that love your work. And you've become real patrons of the City of Liverpool, haven't you?
We have, yes. We've had an ongoing relationship with the city. I mean, we've been fortunate enough in the past to have been asked to represent it at various stages. And in particular during 2008, where Liverpool was European Capital of Culture,
yes,
the city commissioned us to do two major works, both of which are currently on display in the city in different venues. And that really strengthened our roots with the city, because one of them in particular was about the history of Liverpool. It was coinciding with the 800th anniversary of the city. And so we had this mammoth challenge to try and put that whole 108 years into one single painting, which was quite difficult.
One painting.
Yeah. I mean, luckily we before we were artists, we had an academic background, and we were particularly interested in cross-cultural histories and identities and religions. And so all that came to play in the research for the work. And to some extent, it was like doing a little mini thesis. So the kind of logistics of trying to work out all this information and how to cram it into this painting ended up okay, I think, in the end.
But one of the wonderful things about your work is that you are miniaturists, essentially, aren't you? You work on a very, very detailed scale.
Yeah, we're inspired by Indian miniature painting, which is akin to the medieval manuscripts that you'd have in the West. And we would just...
Personal passion
area. Yeah, I know, we like it. We've got in common there.
Yep.
And they've just fascinated us from teenagers when we first went to India, and we came across this wonderful art form. And it wasn't just the skill and the beauty that we appreciated. It was also the humour and the satire, particularly the political satire, which is something that we've carried through in our own works ever since.
Indeed.
So it was just amazing. And this language was just really being thrown by the wayside, neglected in India as something that was backward, you know, something that was from the past. And artists, contemporary artists there, were just busy copying Western kind of canons of art.
Yeah.
And so from that age onwards, we made it our mission. We're going to revive this tradition and make it valid for a contemporary audience. And that's hopefully what we've been doing. So although our language is very ancient, what we have to say is very contemporary.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing I love, because you've used, actually quite closely, you've used some examples of Indian miniature works from the 16th, 17th, 18th century, but then taken the format and the style and put modern characters, political figures into it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's just a matter of reinterpreting the old themes to give them the contemporary relevance. So, for example, there's a really famous Indian miniature painting which shows one of the Mughal Muslim emperors of the time, embracing the Shah of Persia, or the ruler of Persia, and they're standing on this globe, and the Mughal emperor is standing on this mighty lion, you know, represents his character, and the poor Shah, he's standing on this little meek, mild lamb to show his character. So you can tell who actually commissioned the painting just from that. And so we've reinterpreted that actually several times, but the latest reinterpretation is one using exactly the same format but showing Bush and Blair, and it's all around the issue of the Iraq war. And, you know, Blair standing on this poodle, cozying up to Bush, who's standing on this hyena. Which is a symbol of deceit. So we just love reinterpreting old themes and making them relevant for a new audience.
And the idea of putting in, you put in celebrities, you put in people from your environment as well, don't you? And is that because it's not about slavish copying, it's more about the idea of what these sources can inspire in you?
Yeah, I think we've always been interested in the way that history can inform the present. And so part of that reinterpretation is trying to show the validity of not just the kind of issues, the politics and the kind of social context of the past and how they continue in the present, but also the language of the past and how that is still valid. And unfortunately, a language that's pretty much been lost in contemporary art practice.
Mm.
You know, the idea of using flowers as symbolism, for example, or colour as symbolism.
Or animals. Peacocks. You're obviously obsessed with peacocks, as am I.
Well, they're beautiful and things, aren't they?
They are miraculous things, aren't they? And the colour. So all that symbolism, I completely agree. It is a lost language.
Yeah, we'd love to revive that. And we understand that a lot of people won't understand the finer detail of our work until they relearn that language. But fortunately or unfortunately, depending on where you look at it, we have reams of text and artist interpretations that go alongside our artworks. And for those that want to read it, you know, the interpretations are there, and we would like to think that through there we're reviving, you know, a small proportion of the society, this beautiful language that we've grown up, you know, loving, you know, since childhood, really.
Well, I knew I would love coming to this exhibition. I was so delighted to be invited. Thank you.
Oh, not at all.
And it's called Slaves of Fashion. This is, I mean, it's a big exhibition, actually. You've got two, three rooms of exhibition space.
It's been 3 years in the making, so it's...
3 years. Yeah. But what really struck me, knowing about your miniature work...
Yeah.
Was we are dealing with large pieces.
Yeah, life size. Okay. This is a breakaway for us, I have to say. And it's been quite liberating, actually. It's really lovely to see our work in such large scale. I mean, we've been longing to do this for such a long time.
Really?
And we were trying to figure out how could we do it in a practical way, because, of course, the miniature style technique is so time-consuming.
Okay.
And we're talking about works which are probably about
the figures are life-size, aren't they? And each one is dominated by a figure. So what was the sort of overarching idea behind this then?
Well, the work was really sparked off by a trip to France, quite incidentally, and we were in the Slavery Museum in Nantes, and we came across these textiles which the curator was explaining had been produced in India for the French, specifically for exchanging in Africa for slaves.
Oh my gosh.
And that was a real revelation to us, because I think, you know, we're talking about the transatlantic slave trade here, and most people think that's something to do with the Western Hemisphere, including ourselves at that point. And we didn't realise just how complex that history was, and the fact that India in some way was connected
drawn
to that history in a very direct way. And
So
we came home and we were avidly, these textiles from the French point of view were called Andians, and we came home and started Googling in the word and trying to find out more about this history. And, of course, that opened up a whole floodgate of information about Indian textiles in general, which we then delved deeper into. And from that, we realised that it wasn't, you know, this story of textiles was not really about textiles at all. It was about the history of the globe, the history of empire, colonialism, you know, the conflict, the relationship between trade, conflict and luxury lifestyle. And that's basically what this new series is about, bringing all those ideas together historically, but also wanting to tie in the contemporary relevance as well, because obviously these issues around empire and colonialism, you know, exploitation of labour, particularly within the fashion world, are things,
continuing,
and, you know,
continuing
our consumer
issues.
World are still very much part and parcel of who we are as a community today.
Well, this is what I find so wonderful about this exhibition, is it's both almost microscopic in as much as it deals with individuals, moments, and all these little miniature scenes are anecdotes, they're little messages, aren't they? But the bigger scheme here is giving a chronology of the history of
the world.
Of the world.
It is. I mean, you know, the American Civil War, the French Revolution, Haiti, it's all there. Indian independence. It's definitely not an Indian story, it's a global story. We're just looking at it through the eyes of an Indian sub-story, if you like.
Yeah.
And in fact, all those ideas are tied up in a poem that was also on display at the exhibition, which really brings together, through prose, all the themes that are explored throughout the whole rest of the artworks. And hopefully it'll make a bit more sense to people when they see that poem and come back and hopefully look at the artworks themselves. They'll be able to pick out some of the details and they'll know some of the little stories that are depicted. Because it was quite difficult to try and pigeonhole, if you like, the various themes that we wanted to look at within the wider context of that.
So there's so much crossover.
So each of the exhibition is divided into kind of, not two sections, but complementary parts. You have 11 large-scale batlik fabric artworks, each of which can have a main figure as the kind of focal point. And around each of those figures, you have various little details of other figures and decoration that link into the story of the key portrait being depicted and the theme that particular work is exploring. And then complementing that, there are 9, what we say is more contemporary, overtly political responses to the whole theme of legacies of empire and, you know, ethics of trade and responsible consumers in the world today.
And those are the... See, because, I mean, I'm struck by the combination between the large-scale light boxes, which are sublime. And I came in and I thought, my goodness, they are like stained glass windows. This is heaven to see your work on a large scale. And then you've got the smaller pieces. I was very excited by the ones that are inspired by Gilray.
So yeah, but we're big fans of Gilray.
He's a satirical artist,
you know.
He's
the humour in his satire, you know, is second to none.
We affiliate with him, don't we?
So his social political outlook.
And he's deeply political, isn't he?
Definitely. And of course, some of the themes he dealt with fitted in beautifully with the themes that we were dealing with. I mean, things like, you know, fighting over areas of the globe, you know, in the kind of Nelson and I think it's Jack Tar, isn't it? They're fighting over the Africa. And yep. In the modern context, we've got Boris Johnson fighting over India with Angela Merkel. So it was just it was an opportunity we couldn't miss to reinterpret some of his works, quite frankly.
And I think this is the other thing that obviously informs all of your work. You're art historians as much as you are working artists, aren't you? And that's essential in a way to put together something on this scale that's going to tell such a big story.
Well, we just love the academic side of being an artist, and not many people kind of equate the two, but we certainly do. I mean, our background is prior to formally becoming artists, kind of officially, we were academics, and we just wanted to carry on that side of our background. And so every work does start with an intense period of research. Sometimes it's actually a hindrance, as it was with this project, because there's so much to research, and we were so engrossed in the research that we almost forgot that we had some paintings to do until the deadline starts looming, and it's like, okay, we've got to decide, you know, we can't research forever. We could go on forever with each theme, whether it was Indigo or Coromandel Coast or, you know, Kashmiri shawls. And there came a point where we had to put the books down and pick up the paintbrushes and start painting.
Yeah. But actually, the books were being picked up in between as well.
They were, you know, there's some, you'd see something on the news or read something in the newspaper and you think, okay, that really connects. We have to put that in too. So then you're scurrying around trying to, you know, connect all the strands again. We're just trying to keep as updated as possible to the 11th hour. So even Donald Trump, some of the themes in the painting that's around him.
I can't imagine how you keep up with Donald Trump in your art.
Well, you know,
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
He's proved a challenge. 4 weeks before Christmas, you know, we were still picking up on his quotes and thinking, okay, we've got to put that in at the 11th hour. So, yeah. But I think all of this is to do with the fact that personally we see ourselves as social political commentators. I know, again, going back to kind of stereotypes of modern art and how modern art is often dictated to us these days. It's all about the individual artists and their inner angst and their own, you know, personalities and emotions. For us, it's not about that. It's about communicating with the public. It's about telling stories and having interconnected narratives between, you know, who we are of the past and today.
But the creating art that becomes then a document for future generations to understand our own time, which is something that we've sort of lost, isn't it? That the artist was a commentator.
Yes, exactly. It's become almost a, you know, when we were going through the art system again, you know, it was something that was really frowned upon. And in fact, the fact that we had chosen to use the ancient Indian miniature tradition to inspire our own work was really sort of looked down upon. We were told that it was backward and outdated, had no place whatsoever in contemporary art. So in a way it was good because it challenged us to get up and say, well, hang on a minute, it has a real place here. But that was also to do with the sort of, ingrained prejudice, if I may say, you know, with the sort of Western outlook on valuations of art and how art is defined by the Western benchmark. And for us, you know, we saw that as much as an attack on our Indian heritage and identity as our practice as artists and our kind of, you know, wanting to express ourselves in the way that we felt was true to who we were, not, you know, true to whatever was being taught at the, you know, in our course at that time.
Absolutely. And I mean, in terms of, we should probably focus in on a couple. Okay. Because I mean, it's just wonderful talking. But I want to look at the art itself. Now, this one, I have to say, okay. Obviously.
the medieval context.
So tell me a little bit about this one, because it did strike me as soon as I got in the door.
Well, this is a painting, well, I shouldn't say painting, because it's one of the light boxes. It's one of the artworks titled Silks and Quilts. So it's obviously looking at the history of silk and quilts from India and how that connects to particularly the European markets. It starts off in the medieval period, where we have Queen Isabella of Spain, who's standing sort of centrally within the composition there, and she has various objects around her. And she's also holding objects in her hands, some of which are black and white representations of actual engravings that we have collected.
Because I should say detail. That,
we'll move into that.
Again, last night it was very busy and I wanted to get up. With your art, I just want to press my face up so close because it is incredible, the detail there. So holding a picture of Christopher Columbus.
Well, yes, well, because see, the whole idea, what we wanted to show, we talked about different themes within different artworks, and this is the kind of beginning, in a way, of the story, because you have this idea of exploration but also exploitation through exploration.
Absolutely.
And Christopher Columbus kind of epitomizes that for us. He was someone that was sponsored by Queen Isabella to go out and find, initially, India, of course,
uh-huh.
because of the wealth of India and these wonderful tales of the riches of India, which of course included their wonderful, you know, the highly desired fabrics and textiles of that time. Of course, he didn't find India, he found somewhere else. But the kind of connection goes back to India because what he discovered were new nations that were basically conquered by Spain and Portugal in the end. And it enabled them to gain wealth through, again, slavery, the silver mines, the gold mines. And that discovery then inputted into the whole economy of the trade in Indian textiles, because many of the European countries were, of course, exchanging textiles for silver and gold. India was not really interested in anything else. They didn't need anything else from anybody. And so it became that discovery and that conquest and that enslavement of people became really important to that whole story of the trade in Indian textiles. And so essentially that's where this image starts. But then around the image itself, you have various examples of the different types of beautifully produced fabrics that were either silk-based or silk-embroidered, and also the quilted fabrics that were then traded with Europe through that initially Portuguese connection, but then the Dutch, the French, the English, and of course all the other colonialists that decided they wanted a piece of the action in India.
But I mean, this is the thing. There's a luxury and a joy in all of these images, but there's also conflict and exploitation and stories that are unsettling as much as obviously exciting as well, with characters from history.
Well, I think it was the challenge for us was to try and depict two things. One was our passion for and excitement about the discovery that India's heritage in textiles was so pioneering and so diverse and so rich. And it's something that, you
so
know...
So coveted in a way.
Yes,
coveted,
pride in
coveted,
that.
Coveted,
yes. Pride in that. Everybody
loves wants
Indian fabric.
Yeah, everybody wants a piece of that.
Exactly.
And in a way, that's why it becomes so controversial, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that was one. So the joy, I guess, and the celebration of textiles comes through the works. But at the same time, we didn't want to lose sight of the fact that this was linked to, in a way, the kind of the beginnings of the commercial, you know, the sort of
multinational kind of
corporate monopolies on trade and the way we have the beginnings of the consumer society and the materialistic lifestyle that we all know today, but actually goes back several centuries to this initial trade with India and other places and the colonialism and empire, and that was all basically founded on trying to control people and resources in order to obtain these wonderful commodities that were desired by the West. And so that darker side is also...
The darker side is there throughout. But I think what's also interesting, obviously this is about fashion as much as anything else.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to think of fashion as a modern concept. Mm. This shows that fashion, in terms of what people wore, how they expressed themselves, and the way that they used materials, objects. Mm. I mean, you've got jewels, you've got that. That is absolutely stunning, that teardrop-shaped piece there. But this idea that all of this is a statement about fashion and how material comes into that.
Particularly because the textiles initially were so expensive, and even the dye set as indigo, which is also represented, that they were only affordable by the rich. Yeah. And so it was a symbol of status, and it did go with the luxury lifestyle. And, you know, that was the initial demand until
mechanisation,
yeah, the Industrial Revolution. England could not compete with the kind of skill involved in Indian textiles. And so until that happened and prices, you know, would drop because of that mass production, it was very much part of the luxury lifestyle scene.
And you actually work with material as well, don't you? Fabrics and embroidery. Is that...
Well, we are, personally, you're talking about, we do usually create our own outfits.
Yeah.
I must admit, we don't have much time for that these days. But I think also there's a connection, not where we've produced it, but where fashion designers have been inspired by our work. So a couple of years back, the Indian fashion designer who's top of his league in India, which we were delighted to collaborate with him.
Gosh, I
know. He created his whole spring-summer season of, I think, 2015, around our work. And he was using, not handcrafted, actually. There were some elements of handcrafted embroidery, but it was mainly digital technologies that he used. So it was printed artworks on his beautifully draped and designed garments that sort of hit the catwalks.
Gosh, that's so exciting.
It was wonderful to see that translated.
But what a full circle story, in a way, of creating these sort of historical narratives.
Yes,
it's
funny how things have tied in our lives. Yeah.
Do you have a personal favourite?
I think I like Calico Jack because there were some quite amusing stories.
Should we go and talk about Calico Jack? Yeah, because so as we go past, just to keep the listeners involved, we've just come from Sylt.
Okay, so we're now walking past the work, which is to do with the Dutch connection, and it's called Coromandel because they had huge trade connections with the Coromandel coast of India, which is the southern eastern coast of India, and it's linking in the trade in textiles with the spice trade, which again was a very lucrative trade for the European traders to the east. And originally, the value of Indian textiles was not in their kind of worth as a commodity that people would wear and use in the West, but their bartering value. So these were exchanged in Indonesia for these valuable spices that were then brought back to Europe to, you know, to enflavor people's food. Well, the high and mighty's table. Nobody else could afford them.
As an exercise in historical fashion, I'm stunned because, you know, your medieval fabrics and dress art spot on, and then look, yeah, this incredible Dutch outfit. And then this is obviously the poster for the exhibition.
This is Indigo. So you obviously don't have the historical costume here because what you have
you have
a 17th century queen, Mumtaz Mahal, who, top half, she's wearing her 17th century costume.
I just noticed she's got M&Ms in her pocket.
She has.
Well, I didn't see that yesterday.
Well, indigo teen is a blue dye used in M&Ms, blue M&Ms. So this whole work is about the indigo dye, which went, you know, was used in India for thousands of years before becoming, exported to the West. And Mumtaz has this beautiful, you know, 17th century costume on the top half. She's smothered in jewels, you know, befitting her status and her luxury lifestyle, which again, you know, indigo was seen as blue gold, literally. It was so expensive to buy. And the bottom half, she's wearing these blue jeans. And immediately I would think people will say, well, how do those two things go together? Most people think of blue jeans as Levi's, America, a modern, you know, fashion statement. But of course, during our research, this is one of the fascinating things. We found out so many stories and hidden histories that I'm sure most people are not aware of, that the denim fabric actually originates in India. The 16th century sailors of a little town of Dongri, which is the word dungaree comes from.
No.
Where they used to wear this sturdy cloth to make sails and then to make trousers. And then, you know, the Italians took it to Genoa, where you get blue jeans coming from Genoa. And so it was turning, you know, this whole idea of cultural ownership on its head, that where, you know, people identify certain objects with a particular culture and point in time, and we wanted to challenge those notions and get people to think about other ways of looking at objects.
But also, this podcast is called The Art Detective. You are detectives, aren't you? I mean, you're uncovering stories, you're uncovering these connections. And then
we just love doing that.
I bet, but then having the ability to be miniaturists, to be able to put in these tiny stories into a larger narrative, it's amazing.
Well, we have to be miniaturists to get them in the canvas, literally.
Absolutely.
So I think if we had worked on a large scale, it would just be an impossible task. So we're just fortunate that we love the miniature style.
Yeah, and so you've obviously got, in the background there, you've got the Taj Mahal, you've got...
The Taj Mahal represents not only, I mean, the link to Mumtaz Mahal, who's buried, you know, beneath the Taj Mahal, but Agra, where the Taj Mahal is one of the main centres, or was one of the main centres for indigo production, and it was kind of the designer label of indigo. There were different varieties of indigo. But what the West wanted, of course, was the best, and the best came from Agra.
Mm.
And then in the bottom half of the painting, you have the darker side of the indigo trade. So yes. You have, you know, ultimately who has paid for that price and that demand. And on the one hand, you have the poor Indian peasants who were forced to grow indigo as a cash crop rather than growing food. And that resulted in many famines in the Bengal region where indigo was grown. And then on the other hand, you have an African slave who, you know, once the British and the French and the Portuguese had their own plantations in the Americas, they set up their own indigo plantations and cut out the Indian
using slave labour.
Middleman. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, again, you've got these characters. I could see Elizabeth I down there, and Nelson and Napoleon.
Yeah, but, well, they represent the kind of the link between indigo and conflict,
you know, or trade,
or the demand for indigo. So they're there to represent the fact that drawing that is just an example of drawing the French Anglo wars. Of course, the indigo demand was up because the blue uniforms of the soldiers and the troops. You know, they needed more dye, so they got more dye from India. But the reverse of that is when you had the colonized, the Haiti kind of rebellions. In the Americas, where the indigo plantations were, where the British were then sourcing it, when they collapsed, of course, they had to go back to India for their indigo. So there were these fluctuations in the Indian-grown indigo dictated by politics.
Oh, I mean, centuries of stories in this one. Now, I know you've got all sorts of interviews and amazing things you're doing today. I'm aware of this.
Let's
go to your favourite, and we'll do this one last, because I'm already excited. There's a bird in this.
Oh, magpie. Okay,
like I love birds. I love birds. Hence the peacock fascination.
Well, it's an odd one out, really, this particular work, because all the others are women-focused, and this one we have a gentleman, perhaps not quite a gentleman, if you discover that he's also a pirate. But I don't know, a lot of the East India Company and the other corporates were as much pirates as this young man as well, anyway. So,
he's the only male.
He's the only male figure. And he represents Calico. He's actually based on a historical pirate called Calico Jack, who was known for wearing calico, which is a cloth from India, you know, with the vibrant colours, and his jackets were made from calico. So we thought he would be the ideal person to represent the whole theme of not just calico in terms of the history of the cloth, but also the kind of political intrigue, the conflict aspects of what went hand in hand with obtaining the cloth from India, but also
pirating, theft,
plunder of India, and ultimately to gain control of Indian resources, to control the trade in textiles. So he's the central figure. And then you have various stories around where, particularly in the bottom half, where there's little anecdotes about how the British particularly were so keen to get the trade from India that they kind of came up with all sorts of trickery ideas to kind of get a foothold in India. So there was one where to do with the Kashmiri shawls, which has come from the Kashmiri goats. And
This is the goat here.
Yes, and you see this goat in this stormy sea, kind of drowning.
I love the way you've done the waves in the clouds. It's beautiful.
With all the turmoil. And the story behind that is that William Moorcroft, who was in the employ of the East India Company, he was really keen that Britain should overtake the Kashmiri shawl industry, and he tried to smuggle goats out of India so that they could come to England and they could
breed
them here and take over the industry. And he put all the male goats on one ship and the females on another,
and one
of the ships sank, so he lost half of his goats. And to be honest, we chuckled quite loudly when we read that, because it was it serves you right.
Yeah. So it was the male goats that went.
We're not sure which one. But it didn't work, because obviously you need and then you have this other detail here where you have these two horses on a raft going along the river in the background, and that relates to a newspaper article actually that we read about how
from the 1800s.
So it was during the time of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, who was like the kind of emperor of Punjab at the time, and this was the last region to be annexed to the British Empire under the Raj. And they were really keen to navigate and learn how to get into the heart of this region called Sindh. And so what they did is they gifted this king two big English horses, because Indian horses are very small and skinny. So
the article actually explains
that the reason they gifted him these two big horses was to see how this king would get them up the river into the heart of Sindh, so that they could learn
follow the same route,
learn the routes, and then So the story goes that this Muslim saint saw this happening. He was standing by the river and he saw these British horses going up this raft because Ranjit Singh had figured out a way to get these horses because it's so difficult over land in those days. There weren't roads like you have today.
It's almost like espionage.
Exactly. And so he's got his hands in the air and he literally was saying, "Alas, Sindh is now gone since the English have seen the river, which is the road to conquest."
Oh, I love it. I mean, this is it. I'm almost overwhelmed by the level of stories and detail in here. There is a book, obviously, a catalogue to accompany the
well, not as yet, unfortunately. We were working on that. I think it's taken 3 years to put the work together, the artwork, and we kind of just ran out of time too. But the work is actually going to be touring, and so we're hopefully going to try and get a book published, because I think a lot is going to be lost on the audiences that come in. And we have an app which is just relating to the Indigo artwork, which will give people a sense of the detail of narrative within each.
I mean, I tried using that last night. It's amazing. So you sort of hold up, you get the code and it gives you all of the back narrative. But again, you know, it just deserves to be fully unpacked and explained. Yeah. I was going around with the cats with the...
Yeah, there are some extended titles within the gallery space itself. But not a formal book, but there are some extended texts so people can learn a little bit more about all
still
the
very much cut down, I have to say. Yeah. But they give a bit more than the captions on the wall, which there are limitations to that for the galleries. So.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I can't tell you how much I adore your work, because as a medievalist, this idea of narratives within narratives, symbolism, and the colour and light and beauty of them. They're extraordinary works.
I mean, that was medieval art for you, wasn't it? And we're big fans of medieval art for that reason.
How long is the exhibition running for?
It's running until the 20th of May this year, and then it goes on to Wolverhampton, I think from July through to September or thereabouts. Yeah. But all the details will be up on the Walker Art Gallery website.
Excellent. And can people follow your work? Are you on...
They can. Facebook? Well, we're very bad. Well, we've just about managed to keep going a Facebook page.
Well done.
I mean, we've got our website, of course. Yes. And we have a Twitter account, which we don't get time to Twitter about anything. But I think our Facebook page and our website are the best places people can learn more about us and our work.
I have enjoyed this so much. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to me. It is a pleasure. And I hope we'll carry on the conversation. And I'd love to see future works of yours as well.
Stay connected, everyone.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.